clear he was engaging in battles that were almost suicidal in nature. He went into battles where he executed prisoners, ordered no prisoners to be taken.
That was Scott Anderson discussing Lawrence of Arabia.
They were in this kind of hermetically sealed little world that their mother controlled very closely, and they knew there was this wonderful world outside.
And that was Helen Rappaport talking about the lives of the four Romanov Grand Duchesses. Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast. I'm Rob Attar and I'm the editor of BBC History Magazine, which is the UK's best-selling history magazine. It is available in all good newsagents, or you can take out a subscription from anywhere in the world. Head to historyextra.com/subscribe-today for the latest subscription offers. And if you have a digital device, we have editions available for the iPad, iPhone, Kindle, Kindle Fire, Google Play and Zinio. And for details of these, visit historyextra.com/digital. Our first guest this week is Scott Anderson. Scott is a veteran war correspondent who has reported from conflicts around the globe. He is also a successful author, whose latest book is a biography of T.E. Lawrence, better known, of course, as Lawrence of Arabia. On a recent visit to Bristol, Scott popped into our studios to share his thoughts about this enigmatic British hero. For listeners out there, if there are some who've never heard of Lawrence of Arabia, could you just briefly explain who he was and why is he so important?
Yeah, his name was Thomas Edward Lawrence, better known as T.E. Lawrence, and he was a junior British officer. He was 28 years old in 1916 when the Arab Revolt started in what was modern-day Saudi Arabia. And Lawrence went over initially on a sightseeing trip. And he ended up becoming the chief liaison officer between the British forces who were based in Egypt, in Cairo, and the Arab rebel forces in Arabia. And he spent the next 2 years until the end of the war working with the Arab tribes, uniting the Arab tribes to fight for the Arab Revolt, and was really the primary battlefield commander of the Arab rebels in the march to Damascus in Syria.
So this is during the First World War?
That's right.
And the Arab Revolt, that was against the Ottoman Empire, is that right?
That's right. The Ottoman Turks came into the war. They were allied with Germany, so they were opposed to Britain and France. And Britain led the Allied war effort in the Middle East, and primarily from British-controlled Egypt. So the revolt for the first 2 years of the war, there were a lot of soundings back and forth with the Arabs, especially King Hussein in what's called the Hejaz, which is in central modern-day Saudi Arabia, to get the Arabs to rebel against the Turks. And after really very extravagant promises from the British of sweeping Arab independence, King Hussein led his forces into rebellion against the Turks.
So why do you think Lawrence felt this sort of attachment to the Arab people that he wanted to then go and become a leader for them? What was it about them that made him want to do that?
Well, prior to the war, he was an Oxford scholar, and he had gone out to northern Syria he had worked on an archaeological site at this place, this right on the modern border of Turkey and Syria. And he spent most of 5 years there. And he really came to, well, both to love the Arab culture, but also to have a real understanding of how it worked. And even more than an archaeologist, he was almost more of a cultural anthropologist. And he really studied the clan and tribal structure of Arab society, which was very important to him when he got to Arabia, where those clan and tribal structures were just that much, because it's that much more conservative in Arabia than in Syria. These affiliations and feuds and vendettas were even more pronounced in Arabia. So he was uniquely suited to this role of trying to unite a lot of the Bedouin tribes, the Arab tribes. He was one of those people who just, I think, had this kind of instant affinity for a foreign culture. And for him, it was the Arab culture.
And so this period went on to become a hugely important few years in the what would be the formation of the modern Middle East.
That's right.
What did Lawrence himself want to happen there? What was his vision for the Middle East?
Well, as I said, the Arabs, in order to revolt, in order to ally themselves with the British, they had been promised just a couple of little enclaves, modern-day Lebanon, modern-day southern Iraq. Virtually, the British promised the Arabs independence of virtually the entire Middle East. Then they immediately turned around and made a secret deal. The British made a secret deal with the French called the Sykes-Picot Agreement that really reneged on almost all the promises that had just been made to the Arabs. Lawrence was very aware of both of these conflicting promises. And I think what happened with Lawrence, the longer he spent in the field and the more he played the central role in enlisting Arabs to fight, again, for the cause of independence, but also knowing that the probability was at the end of the war, they were going to be betrayed, the promises were going to be thrown out. I think it caused him a really tremendous moral crisis. And in his war memoir, Seven Pillars of Wisdom, he talks about how he felt a fraud and a charlatan. And so I think it being in the field and seeing men fighting and die for a cause that he was actively encouraging them to do so for, I think it really affected him very deeply.
Do you think that might be partly why he sort of retreated from life, didn't he, in his later years? Do you think that might have influenced that change of his life?
I do. I think after the war, Lawrence went to the Paris Peace Conference as a liaison to King Hussein's son, Faisal, to represent Arab interests and to try to get the British government to live up to the promises that had been made to the Arabs. He had some allies initially in the British Foreign Office, but he was gradually seen as an obstacle to having a final peace settlement made, to the point where he was almost officially banned from any involvement in the Paris Peace Conference and prevented from continuing his liaison role with Faisal. So I think his disillusionment after the war, part of it was that he felt he had had a hand in this betrayal of the promises made to the Arabs. But then on a more personal level, he kind of went a bit mad out in the battlefield. Towards the end of the war, it was clear he was engaging in battles that were almost suicidal in nature. He went into battles where he executed prisoners, ordered no prisoners to be taken. And it's clear in his post-war life that he was suffering from what we'd refer to today as post-traumatic stress disorder. He had several bouts with depression, contemplated suicide, and became more and more reclusive. Also changed his name twice and legally changed it. So he became a really kind of a sad and reclusive figure. And I think he was always haunted both on the intellectual level of the involvement in the betrayal of the Arabs, but on an emotional level of just what the war had done to him.
And for your biography of Lawrence, you've taken a group approach, haven't you? You've focused on quite a few of the people that were around Lawrence at this time. Why did you decide to go down that road for the book?
Lawrence is the primary character in the book. I would say there's a supporting cast of three other secondary characters. And in contemplating what I could write about Lawrence that was new, because there have been 70-some-odd biographies done on him, one thing that jumped out at me was that I went back to the central riddle of his life, which I think is, in essence, is how did he do it? How did this 28-year-old Oxford scholar, without a single day of military training, how did that guy go off to Arabia and become this battlefield commander of a rebel army? And I think part of the answer is that he was able to do it because no one was paying that much attention in the leadership. Certainly from the British standpoint, the vast majority of the blood and treasure that was being expended was on the Western Front. This was in the midst of World War I. So if this rather eccentric guy could go off to Arabia and cause problems for the Turkish enemy, the Turks being allied with the Germans, then he was given tremendous freedom of movement and action to do so. And when I realized that about Lawrence, and it was a little bit of a miniature epiphany about Lawrence, I thought, well, if that was true about the British, who were by far the biggest imperial players in the region at the time, then it must have been true about the other warring factions. So once I had that idea, I started looking around for other people and found an American who was the only American field intelligence officer, almost exactly Lawrence's age. He was 1 year older, a German counterintelligence officer and a Jewish settler in Palestine. So it was this amazing moment where, because so much of the world's attention was focused elsewhere, and specifically on the Western and the Eastern fronts, that these men with very modest resumes, but with a certain brilliance and a talent for treachery, were able to have an outsized effect on history. Lawrence, of course, being the one that the world remembers, and the other three men I write about really very few people have heard of them. But again, it had somewhat similar trajectories to Lawrence.
And you mentioned earlier about there being a Jewish settler then. Clearly, this period became also important because of the formation of the State of Israel eventually. A lot of that was decided in this First World War period. What was Lawrence's own view about the future of what was then Palestine?
Well, in around about 1916, the Balfour Declaration, which was from the British Foreign Secretary, Balfour, and it very carefully worded that the British government, I can't remember the exact wording, but it would look with favor on increased Jewish immigration into Palestine. But it was a very carefully calibrated statement designed to win over the opinion of international Jewry, or at least of the Zionists, people who had this idea, the Jews who had this idea of a return to Palestine, designed to win them over to the war cause. When Lawrence first heard that the Balfour Declaration was in the works, he was aghast because he just saw that the Jews and the resident Palestinian population were going to, it meant war. But as time went on, he also realized it was a fait accompli. Certainly once the Balfour Declaration came out in November of 1917, there was no way to get the horse back in the barn. If Lawrence was anything, he was a born pragmatist. And so when the Balfour Declaration came out, he accepted it as a fait accompli and tried to use it to win further concessions from the British government in the Arab cause.
Now, Lawrence of Arabia today is still a very well-known name around the world. He's almost, I guess he is an iconic figure. Was that something that was around at the time, or did he become more famous posthumously?
Lawrence was sort of discovered at two very specific times. Lowell Thomas, who was an American journalist slash huckster, discovered Lawrence right at the closing days of the war, and he turned Lawrence into a matinee idol. Lowell Thomas put on this kind of a moving picture show that played in London and then and proceeded to play all across Great Britain, and it was a massive hit. And with Lawrence as this romantic figure in robes and leading the Arabs into battle and, you know, going over sand dunes. They even had dancing girls in the Lowell Thomas show. And over a million people in Britain came out to see it, including the King and Queen of England. So Lawrence, by 1919, had huge fame. And yet, it was a fame he really wanted to reject. And that's when he first changed his name and really went into hiding. And then the second time was, of course, the David Lean movie in 1962. And, you know, a movie that even today is considered one of the greatest films of all time. And certainly for a worldwide audience, I think the movie made Lawrence a household name.
And in his own day, how was Lawrence viewed by people back in Britain? What did they think of him?
Initially, because of the Lowell Thomas show, he was, you know, World War One was such a ghastly, awful war. And certainly it was very hard to tart up the Western Front, this grinding, awful war where men died in utter anonymity. And now you had this sort of very romantic figure that people could rally around and find some romanticism or some glamour out of this horrific catastrophe that had happened. So I think initially, in the popular view, he was viewed as this very romantic, dashing figure. The irony is that at the same time that the British public were learning of Lawrence in 1919, 1920, he was being seen by the British government as the enemy within, as the man who wouldn't let go of representing the Arab cause when the government just wanted to cut the knot and, you know, make the peace treaty with France. Together, they would divide up the Middle East into their imperial spheres. So it's this great irony that I think among the public, he was seen as a matinee idol, while within the British government, he was increasingly seen as almost a traitor within.
So I suppose the British government can't have been too pleased that he suddenly had this big popular appeal behind
him. No, that's right. And it goes to the peculiarities of Lawrence. He never tried to use that popularity to really push his own agenda, which he probably could have. He really could have used it for his own political benefit. Instead, he just wanted to disappear, and he pretty effectively disappeared.
And how important do you think his writings were to his later influence?
I think a lot. Yeah, Seven Pillars and Wisdom, his war memoir, has been translated into 70 languages, something like that, and it's still in print all around the world. His aspiration was that it was going to become known as one of the great works of Western literature. I don't think it achieved that level. But I do think that what makes the books still resonate is it was one of the first memoir where a man at war is really talking about just how awful it is. And there are passages in Seven Pillars that read so much like a modern depiction of war. And this was very unusual at the time. This was still at a time, and it was part of the disjuncture that happened with World War I. Couldn't tart up that war to make it sound in any way romantic or glamorous. But really, it was the British poets sort of capture that move away from the romanticism of war. But as far as fiction writers or memoirists, Lawrence is one of the first to really talk about just how awful it was.
Coming on to the present day, how do people in the Middle East nowadays view Lawrence? Is he seen as a champion of them, or do they have sort of slightly more mixed feelings about him?
They have mixed feelings about him. In certain countries, I think he's still remembered fondly. In other ones, and I think it has a lot to do with the politics in those countries. I think a lot of people feel that he didn't really work for the Arab cause, that he was a kind of a British agent, and they don't distinguish between him and the British Empire coming in and imposing their will and the betrayal of the Arabs at the time. On a more personal level, I think that probably in most of the Middle East and most of the Arab world, they're a bit tired of hearing about him. I mean, you know, the Arab revolt is their creation story. And the idea that, certainly it comes across in the movie that there always has to be this white European at center stage, I think they find galling. And understandably so, but the reality is he really did play a crucial and central role in helping bring the Arab revolt to fruition.
And I suppose actually we're living in a time when again the Middle East is in quite a state of flux. Do you see many parallels between today and Lawrence's own time?
Yes, I think that what we're seeing in the Middle East today is almost exactly what Lawrence was warning about back in at the end of the war in 1918, 1919. He saw disaster coming if the Western empires, and again the victors were France and Britain, if they tried to impose their colonial will on the region, and his voice was lost, and instead they divided up exactly the way they wanted to in this very much of a colonial mindset, and the whole thing blew up within a year. By 1920, the entire Middle East was aflame against both British and French presence. But what happened, all that sort of got patched over, and these artificial countries that were established at that time lasted for about 95 years. They lasted till the Arab Spring, and now what you're seeing is these artificial creations all kind of falling apart. I mean, Iraq today is essentially three countries. Libya is three countries. And both those countries, Iraq and Libya, are divided up very much along the lines that the religious and ethnic lines that existed, that the Ottomans took into account and kept as separate districts. And the whole Ottoman system was to give local groups a great deal of autonomy. When the British and French came in, they pushed these people together and created these artificial states. And this was something that Lawrence was very aware of and was warning against. Really what I think we're seeing across the Middle East now is a reversion back to the way the region looked under the Ottomans.
So it actually wouldn't be too unfamiliar to Lawrence if he were alive today.
No, and I think that if Lawrence were alive today, and I think he would say, "I told you so." he wasn't alone. There were a few other people who knew the region well, who were also warning about this. And I find parallels between what Lawrence was warning the British against, as opposed to what a few people who knew Iraq were warning the Americans against in 2003, prior to the American invasion of Iraq. There was a few voices out there saying this is a really complicated society, and these people are not going to all rush to the street and throw roses at American soldiers as liberators. There's these very deep ethnic and religious fault lines that run through Iraq, and things are going to start falling apart. And those voices, just like Lawrence's, were lost or ignored, and disaster came.
So we're now talking all the time about the First World War because of the centenary of that. How do you think Lawrence should fit into those kind of centenary commemorations? Or do you think he will fit in? Will he be overshadowed by the Western Front and that kind of thing?
I think to a degree. I mean, the Middle Eastern front of the war has always been, certainly for British and French, has always been off to the side, and the Western Front being at the center. And for good reason. Both those countries lost over 1 million men, and the vast majority of them on the Western Front. You know, the ultimate irony of that, though, is that even as the war was going on, and, you know, as I said, that Lawrence had this freedom of movement because no one really cared that much. No one 100 years ago could have imagined that the Middle East was going to become the strategic heart of the world, the most vital corner of the world. And it's quite amazing if you go back to World War I and you look at, you know, the not just the blood and treasure that was expended, but even the diplomatic deliberations that went on at the Paris Peace Conference. For every hour that was spent talking about what was going to happen in the Middle East, there were 100 hours spent talking about what was going to happen in Belgium, say. So it's one of those quirks of history that everyone's attention was kind of looking in the wrong direction.
So how do you think they should be remembering Lawrence then, as we come on to 100 years since his kind of prime moment?
You know, he still has this resonance, and I think people see him as this kind of a Shakespearean tragic figure of a very peculiar man, a flawed man, but who tried to do the right thing and was kind of swallowed up by the machinery, you know, greater forces at work, but also as a man who was putting out the warning of what was coming if you didn't start listening. He saw the end of the colonial and imperial age, and there were a few people at the time that did. And, of course, these voices were just overlooked, and so calamity followed.
That was Scott Anderson. Scott's book, Lawrence in Arabia, War, Deceit, Imperial Folly, and the Making of the Modern Middle East, is out now, published by Atlantic in the UK and Doubleday in the US. We ran a review of the book in our April edition, which is on sale now. Also in this month's magazine, Professor Ian Kershaw questions why Adolf Hitler fascinates us more than other historical monsters. Meanwhile, we're exploring the mysteries of Shakespeare's life, challenging myths about Pocahontas, and discovering how beans once thought to be a powerful aphrodisiac. Look out for our April issue in all good newsagents and in our many digital formats. Before our next interview, it's time for the latest history news with our website editor, Emma McFarlane.
An 18th century chastity belt and phallic Roman amulets are to be used to enrich sex education for secondary school pupils. In an attempt to help students discuss challenging topics, researchers from the University of Exeter are to launch a new taster course for schools that teaches sex education through the examination and discussion of ancient artefacts. The Sex and History Project will see youngsters aged between 14 and 19 discuss illustrations of objects, including an ivory copulating couple and a 19th century carving of a clamshell. The items, from the collection of Sir Henry Wellcome, have been stored for decades in the vaults of the Science Museum at Blythe House and have never been on public display. You can read more about this story at historyextra.com. In other news, a rare Ming-era cup has sold at auction in Hong Kong for a record-breaking $36 million. The porcelain cup, decorated with a painting of a rooster, hen and chicks, was made in the late 15th century. It was bought on Tuesday by a multi-millionaire art collector from Shanghai. The 500-year-old cup, which measures just 3.1 inches in diameter, is reportedly one of only 17 in the world. Meanwhile, new research suggests that Offa's Dyke, a massive earthwork that roughly follows the modern border between England and Wales, was actually constructed at least a century before the reign of the king whose name it takes. Traditionally considered to have been built during the reign of King Offa, who was king of Mercia, the region which covered the Midlands from 757 until 796, new research suggests that it was actually constructed no later than the middle of the 7th century. According to The Telegraph, the new study used radiocarbon dating on parts of the structure. Experts have described it as a tremendously exciting discovery.
Thanks for that, Emma, and please visit historyextra.com for all the latest history news. Biographies of Olga, Tatiana, Maria and Anastasia, the four daughters of Nicholas II of Russia and his wife Alexandra, are often overshadowed by their assassination by Bolshevik forces in 1918. Helen Rappaport's new book, however, draws upon letters and diaries kept by the Romanov sisters during their childhood and teenage years, to offer an intimate portrait of the family's domestic life. Our book's editor, Matt Elton, met up with Helen at her home in Dorset, and she started by explaining the background to the Romanov story.
The parents of the four Romanov sisters were, of course, Nicholas, the last Tsar of Russia, Nicholas II, and his German-born wife, Alexandra of Hesse. And it was, in the sort of royal dynastic scheme of things, a fortunate marriage in that they married for love. It wasn't dynastic expediency. They married for love, and they really just wanted to be living in each other's pockets and pay happy families.
Yes.
And I think if Nicholas could have walked away from the throne and done that, he would have done it, actually. But, of course, there were enormous pressures on her as the empress, as the Tsaritsa, from the moment she married Nicholas, to produce a son and heir. I mean, that was her basic function, always is the function of royal brides, you know, the heir and the spare. Alexandra had four daughters between 1895 and 1901, yes, in the space of 6 years, and in this desperate, desperate desire to have a son. And I think they'd practically given up hope, and they had reached the point where not only was the succession crisis brewing in Russia because of the... They didn't have the law of primogeniture there. It was Salic law. So every male, possible male heir had to be exhausted before any woman could come to the throne. And it was getting very desperate. But worse than that was the nasty and really quite vicious talk about Alexandra as being cursed, as having brought a curse on the family, that the Romanovs were doomed and that Nicholas should divorce her.
How did this, this external pressure and the pressure for a male... child. How did this shape her personality?
Well, it first of all, it pushed her in the direction of a succession of quacks, faith healers, seers, anyone who would offer some kind of weird peasant remedy. All kinds of bizarre advice was offered to her. And she was so, so desperate for that boy that she laid herself open to almost... dabbling with occult practice and basically welcoming in through her door one or two very dubious people, notably a man called Maître Philippe, who came promising he could absolutely make sure that their next child was a boy. And so I think Nicholas got dragged in.
Okay.
Because I think fundamentally Alexandra was pretty much a latent hysteric. She was highly neurotic, and the more desperate she became, the more she clutched at illogical, irrational practice in this desperation to have a son. Because she saw their mission, her and Nicholas's mission, to pass on the Russian throne intact to a son and heir, and not just not in any way a diluted kind of autocracy, a very entrenched, very firm, divine right of kings kind of autocracy.
So focusing obviously on this domestic setup, with all these external pressures, do we get a sense in the early years of these sisters' lives what their family life was like? What was their relationship in the early years with their parents?
Right from the very beginning, despite all the talk abroad and in Russia, oh, what a dreadful disappointment, oh, they've had another girl, they loved their daughters. They doted on their daughters, and they never, ever expressed any kind of disappointment about them. Nicholas, in particular, was a totally hands-on father, quite against the mould of your average Edwardian father. He really did spend time with his children. He played with them, he walked with them, he read to them, he went riding with them. If he could find a spare minute in the day, he engaged with his family, and their life... That life that they shared with their children was all about the family, about love and support, and also very much bolstered by their Christian faith. So right from day one, those children were brought up in a very loving family environment. They weren't consigned to the nursery like many aristocratic or royal princes and princesses, you know, just brought down for tea and off again. You know, the parents... were very closely involved with their children, so much so that after a couple of failed attempts at having governesses for the girls, Alexandra took it over herself.
That's amazing, yeah.
Because she wanted control. Mm. She was very controlling over her daughters, and obsessively so, of course, about her son, the haemophiliac. So what the girls grew up with was an incredible... It was an incredibly strong, loving sense of family and of loyalty to the family, of duty and care. And they kept that to the very bitter end. And I think of all the things that touched me writing the story, it is that sense of love. And it's why I chose that as the epigraph of my book.
Yes. Yes.
Faith, hope, and love.
Yes.
That is the I know it might even sound like a corny kind of quote, and I agonised about it, and I said, no, for me, that absolutely encapsulates what those children, what those girls were brought up with. They were brought up in the Christian faith of being loving, showing sympathy and kindness to others. Do as you would be done by.
That's the thing. The amazing thing about this book, among other things, is how strongly we get a sense of these personalities, of these four individuals. How early on do we get a sense of their characters?
Well, of course, the world, this is the tragedy. The world outside knew nothing of these four girls beyond the pretty official portraits, the photographs that were circulated as postcards of four lovely smiling girls in big hats and white frocks. And it was bland. It was a collective, kind of docile, dutiful image. And people had no comprehension, no sense at all of four very, very different and contrasting personalities. And that is what is so interesting about the girls, that they were so different. But no one ever saw that, of course, except very close friends of the family and trusted members of the entourage.
So, I mean, being the oldest, that add any pressure to being the firstborn?
Do you think? Olga, the eldest... The onus was always on her, and her mother placed it rather unfairly at times, I think, to set an example. Mm. And at one point later on, you know, she was slightly bullied by her mother to almost try and discipline her very, very undisciplined and highly strung brother. And Olga, I think, began to kick over the traces about this as she got older in her teenage years. And I think of all the children, of all the sisters, she suffered emotionally more than the other. She was more volatile, and when she entered her sort of hormonal phase, she became quite grumpy and difficult. And Alexandra in the war years, of course, was complaining to Nicholas how argumentative and she was, and she was just being a fairly normal young woman. So Olga, because of the burden of being the eldest, naturally had to deal with a heightened sense of responsibility of setting an example. The next sister, Tatiana, was the great beauty of the family. She had the most extraordinarily lovely, svelte figure and tipped-up eyes and almost slightly Asiatic look. But she was extremely reserved like her mother, so much so that people thought she was rather haughty. She wasn't. She just was intensely private person. And for me, she remains something of a beautiful enigma.
Really? Okay.
Although... I think of all the girls researching their story, she was the one who shone through to me in the end. And I hadn't taken a lot of notice of Tatiana, to be honest, until I did the research in detail. And suddenly you see this extraordinary, composed, dedicated young woman as a nurse in the war years. She was undoubtedly a highly gifted nurse. She was doing theatre nursing, assisting in operations, you know, administering the ether. She could have gone on if she'd not been a royal princess and been a pioneer nurse, undoubtedly, or even maybe have trained as a doctor. And she shines through with this incredible stoicism, always uncomplaining, always getting on with the work in hand, doing her hospital duties without complaint at a time when poor Olga collapses through a combination of physical exhaustion, because she wasn't very well, and also mentally she couldn't take the trauma of their nursing work. And it wasn't just a matter of mopping the fevered brow by the bedside or reading the odd book. You know, some royal nurses just tiptoed around the perimeter. They, right from the beginning, when they started their Red Cross training, were in the operating theatre, watching amputations, seeing men horribly disfigured and wounded. So Olga, because of her sensitive nature, I think that affected her much more, whereas Tatiana was much more self-controlled. And so they were quite wonderful in the terms of their dedication to the war effort, and they're admirable for that, I think.
Heading back in time to the sense of the sisters being paired up, what do we learn about the younger pair?
Well, this is another way in which, whether by accident or design, Alexandra, in a way, anonymised her daughters by referring them to the big pair and the little pair. So Olga, Tatiana, there was a natural split with the elder two, and then Maria and Anastasia were the little pair. And it kind of destroys a bit of the personality of the girls, and they in turn took it a step further by sometimes in letters or when mentioning each other to other people referred to themselves as Otmar, O-T-M-A, the initial letters of their names. But Maria and Anastasia, again, were very different, contrasting personalities. I think in a way Maria suffered a little bit from being the middle child, and at times got a little bit pushed out because the older two tended to stick together more. And although she was closer in age to Anastasia, who was extremely energetic and demanding and wild and undisciplined and very manipulative, and Maria, being very soft and gentle and docile, suffered at Anastasia's hands. And I found an interesting comment from Tatiana saying how they used to fight like cat and dog, Maria and Anastasia. And Anastasia, complaints made about her for pulling and hair and scratching and kicking. So she's not quite the pretty, pretty little Romanov sister one might imagine. She could be really quite spiteful. She was wild. She was a bit of a free spirit. But as the years went on, in a way, Maria came slightly adrift of that relationship, and it became a more sense of Anastasia playing with Alexei. So Maria, I suppose, of all the four sisters, is the least controversial, but certainly not the least interesting. She was an incredibly long-suffering, stoical, devoted, loved children. She had a wonderfully gentle, earthy kind of Mother Earth personality, but she did, I suppose, within the little pair, get completely overshadowed by Anastasia.
Such a strange decision to pair your children off when there's four of them.
I know, it's a shame. And this awful thing of, in a way, that persisted with Alexandra right through to the end, really, in the war years, when she's writing all these letters to Nicholas. She kind of infantilizes her children. She's still referring to Alexei as baby when he's 13. And she talks about her girlies. Yeah. Well, by then, Olga's over 20. And, you know, they're not girlies anymore. They're young women. And I don't know, it's as though she won't accept that sooner or later they've got to be introduced to the outside world.
Yeah. Illness was a theme. To what extent did their mother and brother's illness affect the shape of their childhood and their young adolescence?
Well, the tragic thing about those girls, and there's many tragic angles to their story, but another one that really came through to me researching the book was that effectively those girls lived their entire lives in the shadow of sickness. Because first of all, Alexandra, by the time she produced a fifth child inside 10 years, plus a phantom pregnancy and at least one miscarriage, was a physical wreck. She was a physical and an emotional wreck. She had never been a well woman. Even before she married Nicholas, her grandmother, Queen Victoria, sent her for a cure at Harrogate because she had suffered from, in her teens, from agonising sciatica. She suffered from a whole catalogue of things, you know, facial neuralgia, migraines, in sleeplessness. So those girls, right from a very tiny age, were aware of mother being indisposed, mama's lying down, mama's got a headache, mama's not feeling well, oh dear, mama didn't come to lunch again, or they go to some ceremony and mother retires to lie down. Now, some of it has been suggested was psychosomatic, or perhaps it was, but the one thing that really struck home to me when I wrote the book was how actually genuinely chronically sick their mother was. Mm. So what you have, and then they have their incredibly precious brother born, who is discovered to have haemophilia, a life-threatening condition where one bang or serious fall or knock could provoke uncontrollable hemorrhage. So they then have the double burden of not only watching out for their mother, but cocooning and protecting their brother and keeping an eye on him. And especially when their mother's indisposed, you know, they're having to keep an eye on Alexei. So effectively, those girls spent their entire lives as carers. Mm-hmm. That's why, so they saw really so little of the world outside because of the nature of their mother's chronic illness and their brother's very generally fragile state. There were times when he was quite robust and well, but it never lasted for very long.
No. So it was all-encompassing. This internal world they lived in was so all-encompassing. Do we get a sense of how they viewed the outside world?
Well, this is the extraordinary thing. I found in the most telling comment, which in a sentence actually encapsulated the whole thing. During the war years, as I said, the older two sisters trained as nurses, but the younger two girls weren't old enough to train, but they did hospital visiting. And eventually they were given their own little hospital near the Alexander Palace, named after them, which was their little domain, because they felt a bit left out that Olga and Tatiana were down in the big city hospital being serious nurses. So anyway, they did a lot of hospital visiting. And one thing, a wonderful memoir I found of one of the wounded officers who was brought to that hospital actually pinpointed it. He said, whenever the girls came to visit, and often they brought Alexei when he was well, they constantly questioned the wounded soldiers and asked them to tell them about the outside life. And that's what it called, the outside life. It was as though they perceived themselves not being in a cage, although one could say, of course, they lived in a gilded cage, but they were in this kind of hermetically sealed little world that their mother controlled very closely. And they knew there was this wonderful world outside.
Yeah.
And they, during the war years, of course, they began catching glimpses of it, if only through seeing and meeting these wounded soldiers who were brought to the hospitals. And there was always, whenever the girls met young women of their own age socially, occasionally, like Rasputin's daughters, they got to know them. The first thing they do is question them about, oh, what parties, what dances did you go? What frock did you wear? Did you go to the theatre? And you get the sense almost these poor girls are being rather deprived.
As they kind of grew into young women, what figures, if any, outside of the family do you feel contributed most to their development?
None.
Yeah.
Really, when you look at it by about, let's say, 1912, the people in their lives are mother, father, Rasputin, Auntie Olga, who they loved and adored. They were fond of Aunt Zenia, as Nicholas's other sisters. They hardly saw their grandmother, the Dowager Empress. I don't think they were particularly close to her. But the people they most gravitated to tended to be the officers in the entourage, particularly the Tsar's personal bodyguard, the Cossack escort, and officers and men of the Imperial yacht, the Standart. Mm. And it's weird. So you see these young teenage girls growing up surrounded by adults and a few ladies in waiting. There were two or three ladies in waiting they loved and trusted. But you don't see them having really any association with young women, young men of their class, of the aristocracy, because Alexandra despised the Russian aristocracy and thought they were pernicious. So, whenever they had a problem, they could only turn to adults and not their friends, or each other, probably more each other.
Yeah, I mean, given this strange setup, what hopes and aspirations did they have for their futures?
I think their aspirations were very simple, to get married and have children and be happy. Mm. But none of them, we don't know an awful lot, because they were trained by their mother to be very circumspect, not to show their feelings. Even in their diaries, they don't really say much about what they feel. I don't think they had any great aspirations beyond just being happy and having a quality family life that their parents had given them. So you don't see them longing for things. just love and human society. I think that's all they really wanted. And, you know, being able to go to the odd ball or the theatre or the opera. But no, their needs, they were really from childhood, they were sufficient unto each other. Yeah. Always were. Always able to amuse each other, look after each other, because they lived in a bubble for a lot of the time.
Mm. At what point did you decide to end the book? And why did you decide to end it at that point?
Oh, I agonised about the end of the book for obvious reasons, because I'd written Ekaterinburg, which is a chapter a day for each day of those last 14 days, right up to the murders, and a detailed forensic description of how they were murdered and how the bodies were disposed of and all the ghastly black comedy of how basically the Bolsheviks cocked it up and made a complete mess of it. And so I knew I couldn't recount all that again. And almost emotionally, I didn't feel I could go through a blow-by-blow account of the murders again. It was such a hard part of the book to write. I knew I had to end it differently and hope that my readers would understand. I put a note in the front that firstly, because of what the other book I'd written, I had to end it at the point where, you know, they go down the cellar steps, but I don't go any further than that, because I didn't want to repeat myself, and also because I do feel very passionately, Ekaterinburg is a book I'm proud of, and that is a standalone title, and I want it to remain so.
What is the major impression or misapprehension about the sisters that you'd like this book to kind of reverse?
Well, I think, as I said at the outset, I don't want people to think they were just four bland little girls in pretty frocks who had nothing, no brains, no personalities, and were totally without interest. They had four very vibrant and fascinating personalities. And also, I just think their sense of devotion to the family and their very sick mother and brother is exemplary. And the extraordinary thing at the end of the book is you get a great, whether you're religious or not, you do get a very powerful sense of their Christian belief, their faith that held that family together, held the girls together. So I just want people to see that they were four lovely young women on the brink of adulthood, and there was life and they longed to grab it, and it was snatched from them.
In terms of your research, what sources did you use, and are there any particular diary entries or letters or other sources that stand out for you?
Well, the sources I have to kind of keep slightly close to my chest. I searched very long and hard. The trouble with the girls' personal diaries and letters is that they destroyed a lot of their diaries, as Alexandra did when they left the Alexander Palace and went to Tobolsk. Their letters are scattered, some are still in private hands, many of course have just disappeared or were destroyed, and you have to search for them in many different places, and it's all very fragmentary. I searched very, very, very hard to find new letters, and I, by great good fortune, a combination of great good fortune and sheer hard work, I uncovered 30 unknown letters written by Anastasia from Tobolsk, when she was a captive, from the Alexander Palace in Tobolsk, which is interesting because during that period of captivity, we had the least, till then, we had the least number of letters written by her. And I was very thrilled and proud of that.
What was the thing that surprised you most during the course of your research?
I think, I wouldn't use the word surprise. I think what was revealing for me as a historian, and thinking I knew that family quite well, having worked on them before, was how I changed my perception of Alexandra, because I don't think I've ever encountered a more tormented woman in history. She was such a physical and emotional wreck by the war years. So I think I learnt to show some compassion for her. She deserves compassion. She also, I know, in some respects has been fairly vilified, but you can't heap all the blame for what was wrong with Russia on her. So I modified my views of her, but I think in the end, it was just wonderful to be able to shine a light on those girls and see them all as rounded human beings, and particularly Tatiana, who'd always been such an enigma to me. Reading her diaries and letters and the accounts of her as a nurse at Tsarskoye Selo during the war years was a revelation, because there was an extraordinarily dedicated and gifted young woman who could have made a major contribution in some way. And I think Tatiana gets a little bit washed over because she looked so beautiful and she was so very, very reserved and never showed her feelings. So she's harder to get to, whereas Anastasia is the obvious one that everyone goes for. Interestingly, I think, probably interestingly, the one I least empathised with was her. Okay. And she's the most mythologised.
If you could ask any one of them a question, what would you ask them?
What I really, really most want to know, and there's so much speculation about this, is how aware they were of how desperate their situation was at the end. Did they think it was the end? I have found evidence, and I use it in the book, that they were all pretty aware that they were going to die and that the game was up. I think Olga certainly was, but I'd like to know whether they clung to hope right to the very last minute, or whether, because you get a sense of them being reconciled at the party of House and Ekaterinburg, of them being reconciled to God and their faith and to whatever life will bring to them. They were very fatalistic, like their parents. I'd like to know how aware they really were of this awful great shadow approaching.
That was Helen Rappaport. Four Sisters, The Lost Lives of the Romanov Grand Duchesses is out now, published by Macmillan, and it's also available in the US as a Kindle title. Well, that's almost all for this week. As always, do get in touch with your views on podcast@historyextra.com, and we might read out some of your messages in future episodes. A few weeks ago, we asked for feedback about our theme tune after listener Andrew Watts got in touch to say that he wasn't a big fan of it. Well, we've had quite a few emails, and so far it seems Andrew is in the minority. Rob Mousley from South Africa has written in to say, "I actually like the theme music. It's distinctive and has pleasant connotations. The History Extra podcast." While Michael Roman writes, "Please, please, please don't change the theme music. I consider it the perfect way to ground my mind for your podcast's tone, pace, gravitas, and during the Christmas quiz, your collective sense of humour. After listening to it as many times as I have for these many years, it's now an institution. Your podcast is one of the most informative and unique sources of information in my little world. Keep it up." Well, thanks for all of your feedback, and do please continue to let us know your views about the podcast, positive or negative. And as well as email, you can keep in touch with us on social media, on facebook.com/historyextra or Twitter @historyextra. And do make sure to visit our website, historyextra.com, where we've got lots of history news, features, image galleries, quizzes, and a whole lot more. Next week, we'll be taking a trip aboard a Tudor ship with Miranda Kaufman, while Selina Todd will be discussing the history of the working classes. Do join us for that. This History Extra podcast was recorded on location in Dorset and in Bristol, and produced by Jack Fletcher.